Hello and welcome everyone to a sort of bonus episode of Popcorn Culture. It is I, your one true and most favorite host, Jazzy J, here to just introduce a brand new podcast that Ben and I have just launched called Through the Griffin Door. If you're a longtime listener of Popcorn Culture, you've probably heard us toss this idea around for a little while, and basically what it is a chapter by chapter read through and then break down an analysis of the entire Harry Potter series. This is an idea we've been like rolling around with for a very long time now, and we've put a lot of time into getting it all ready. We put together this really cool set that we're going to be recording on. And as of last week, the first three episodes, which is the first three chapters of the Philosopher's Stone, have been live. And when I say chapter by chapter read through, I don't mean that we're like literally reading each page out loud. That would be, I think illegal for somebody. But we will have read the chapter ahead of time, and then we'll go through and break it down. So if you want to like read at home along with us, that would be a really fun way to maybe experience the books. Ben and I do have a lot of experience analyzing these exact books, as I'm sure you're aware at this point. If you've already listened to Through the Griffin Door via the YouTube channel or just on whatever podcast player you're listening on right now, then thank you so much. That is amazing. We really appreciate those listens. But if not, if you missed the announcement, then we thought it would be fun to just upload the very first chapter right here on Popcorn Culture so that you could give it a try before, hard committing. But if you enjoy it, then there's a link down in the description. We would so appreciate it if you would go just, click that follow button, give us a subscribe, maybe a rating. That would all be amazing. If you don't like Harry Potter, or if you've already listened to it though, then you can just skip this entire episode right now and go back to your listening pleasure. Choose something else. But otherwise, enjoy the show, and we'll have a brand new episode of Popcorn Culture for you out tomorrow as your regularly scheduled programming. Thanks. Welcome, dear listeners, to a podcast that will transport you to a world of magic, mystery, and endless wonder. Join us as we step through the Griffin Door, your one-way ticket to the enchanting universe of Harry Potter. I'm your host, Jonathan Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be guiding you on the spellbinding journey, chapter by chapter, through the pages of the Wizarding World. But I won't be alone on this adventure. I've brought along my brother, Ben. Together, we're known as the Super Carlin Brothers over on YouTube.
We'll be delving into the captivating world of Harry Potter, exploring the characters, unraveling the mysteries, and discussing all of the hidden gems that make this series a timeless masterpiece.
In case you don't know us, we've both spent the last 11 years combing through this story, writing fan theories, filling in plot holes, hunting for hidden connections, and just living and breathing Harry Potter.
But you may be surprised to learn that in that time, neither of us has actually read through a hard copy of the book. We use them as references, of course, and the ebooks are valuable tools for our research, but we do almost all of our reading via audiobook.
Yeah, so part of why I'm so excited for this podcast is the fact that we are reading a hard copy of the book. We both got a brand new one. I'm already a few chapters in. I can tell you there is hardly a page I have not made notes on. Like, I cannot believe how many little details keep popping out at me, and I cannot wait to just dive into all of them.
Yeah, so whether you're a lifelong fan of the series or a newcomer discovering Hogwarts for the very first time, Through the Griffin Door aims to be a podcast filled with laughter, insights, and of course, endless Potter love.
So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the secrets behind the Griffin Door. Let us begin our journey with the Philosopher's Stone, Chapter 1, The Boy Who Lived.
Oh man, got chills a little bit.
Oh, I know. I was a little bit nervous going through all that. Like, we're really starting. I feel like we've been talking about it forever, and now we're like actually sitting down recording the show.
We're doing the thing. I know. It's been nervous excitement all day, which I think has been it's been really wonderful actually, because there are so many occasions in life where I'm I have apprehension or like anxiety based nerves. Mm-hmm. And this has been like all day. I've sort of like I've known, it's almost like anticipation for, like Christmas morning or something like that. Like, it's like, oh my gosh, like it's actually happening. Today is the day. So I'm so excited to begin.
I know. Yeah. We've been, if you're watching us on YouTube, yeah, we've been building the set around us for the past couple of weeks. It's been really fun having the little pieces arrive and like, finishing it out. And like, we just got all the lighting situated this morning. We recorded everything, got a little test runs in. And, I know you were just reading the first chapter just before we sat down to record.
Yeah.
Making
yeah.
notes.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I know that you've been ahead of me really, like, and kind of delving into the story a bit further in advance than I have been. And, I think like I've almost in the same vein, I've almost been like wanting to hold on to diving into it for the first time properly and like walking into episode one, just as fresh as seemingly possible. So I have both read the chapter, and have re-listened to it two times.
Oh, wow.
So
you've really done a lot of The Boy Who Lived today.
Yeah. So I've spent some time with The Boy Who Lived and honestly, like, I can't even tell you, like, it almost makes me emotional to talk about it in the first place. Like, just like those words put together, The Boy Who Lived, are just so vital and important. And like, you know, we talked about it a little bit in episode zero, but like, I can just so firmly go back to our childhood where me and you and our younger brother Tyler were all sort of like laid out on our parents' bed, and our dad like cracked the book open and started reading this story to us for, you know, the very, very first time.
I know. Yeah, I do. I can still remember it. Us just sitting there and like wondering about like who did it, like who's trying to steal the stone, who's working with Voldemort. And it was like a really drawn out process because like we would get like two chapters a week, like one on Saturday night and one on Sunday night. And
exactly.
Then yep. We'd have to come back next week to find out what happened. And, you know, maybe if it was a really short chapter, we'd get a little extra one. But our dad was really good about it. He's a professional newscaster, so he has like a very good delivery while reading and could do like some voices here and there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, it was really just like a really joyous occasion, something that like, and more than anything else, I would say it was like the thing, like the series in general is like what unlocked reading for me as a young kid. I almost felt like it had been reinforced to me that like reading was something that you were supposed to be aversive to, you know, like,
right. Like it's always just homework.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was like, it was never supposed to be like the fun thing that you got to do.
I know.
And I remember, yeah, obviously eventually I would like literally carry all of the books with me to school in my backpack.
Well, so, you never knew if you might want to read all seven books one day.
You never know. You never know. Just in case you cracked through it. So
I know. I do remember sometimes like in order to avoid doing homework, I would just read Harry Potter. Cause in my mind I was like, well, I'm reading. So it's not like I'm doing something like, you know, I'm not like breaking the rules or anything. I can't. No one could scold me for reading.
It's like, what are you
surely.
Doing up here? Reading books?
Yeah.
No, sir.
Stop reading and do your homework. Like, see, that sentence doesn't make sense, does it?
Right. Yeah. No, of course not. So, anyway, yeah. Obviously, we have a deep love for this story, for these characters, and especially, and most importantly, The Boy Who Lived.
Yeah. So we've been trying to figure out exactly how we wanted to go through chapter by chapter here. And I think, you know, there were times we thought maybe we'd have like, this is a section for sure for foreshadowing. This is a section for characters introduced, and this will be a section for that. And like, as I tried to like lay those out and like list them as we read through, it was complicated because so many things were so many at like counter to so many things or were Easter eggs. So, and as I was going, it was like, maybe the best way to do it is just literally almost go page by page. Cause there's not a page that I did not write on for things that like stood out to me in the book. So, I think maybe we can start, each chapter kind of give like, I think it would be fun also to review the artwork for each chapter. Cause it's also kind of a little iconic.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah.
So yeah, we'll just give a breakdown of what happens in the very first chapter here as we enter the wizarding world. I can tell you that when the first time I heard it, I had no idea what it was about at all. Like, I didn't know magic was going to happen. Like, when we eventually learned that Harry's a wizard, I remember being floored by that. Despite the fact that wizards show up in the first chapter here and do magic, like it didn't. Like, I don't think they use the word wizard until Hagrid tells him he's a wizard, even though people are clearly doing unusual things.
Oh, yeah. No, and it's even really fascinating on the whole that the story itself, you know, like, because I know coming into and discovering Harry Potter, like, I remember finding the book in our house for the first time and picking it up and being like, I don't really think I'm into magicians and sorcerers and, you know, things like that. Because, of course, you know, in the American copy was called the Sorcerer's Stone. And for the most part, almost nobody shy of the stone for which the sorcerer name comes from is ever referred to pretty much as a sorcerer. I think there's right. maybe one occasion where Dumbledore might be referred to as like the greater
greatest sorcerer in the world or something. They have like, maybe it's like one of those titles the ministry hands out.
Right.
Like Gilderoy Lockhart has later on.
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah.
Sorcerer Supreme. No, that's Doctor Strange. Wrong fandom.
Wrong fandom. There you go. But yeah, so chapter one does a lot of things. It's a fairly unique chapter on the whole, even within the realm of the Harry Potter saga, even in spite of the fact that it's the first chapter, but it's one of the very few handful of chapters that is not told through the perspective of Harry. Yeah.
Not only that, it's one of those things I've noticed every single time I read this chapter, but like the reader are referenced in the first chapter, which is fairly unusual as the story unfolds. It also, like, a lot of times when you watch like the pilot episode of a TV show, there's a lot of like things that like that maybe they thought the characters were going to be like, but then clearly as things have unfolded, like maybe the entire world and story hadn't been fleshed out yet. So like things change, and I feel like there's a bunch of little examples of that, but at the same rate, there's a ton of examples of things that show up in like chapter one that go on to be incredibly important in like book seven.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Or like, yeah. Yep. So there is a lot of setup, and there's a lot of like, we tried something and it went a different way.
Right. And one of the most miraculous things to me, I think, about it is that like almost right out of the gate, you get this great big mystery as to like, why was Harry attacked in the first place? And why was he capable of surviving that attack?
Yep.
And you know, those are things that kind of continue to be mysteries for quite some time. But
yeah.
Anyway, so chapter one begins and we get the introduction to the Dursleys, mm-hmm. who are, of course, just seemingly
the worst.
I think like, you know, it's funny a little bit because as I read through it and you sort of like hear like how Mr. Dursley gets ready for work in the morning, like I think that there's a reference to the fact that he puts on like his most boring tie, which like is like one of those things where it's like you can't help but feel the bias of the narrator in this capacity being like, well, certainly Mr. Dursley doesn't think it's the most boring tie in the world.
Right. Else does he? And it's just like he's going out of his way to be mundane.
Well, and that's the question, because like, you know, when you read you know, like as he's getting ready and you're sort of like, you know, getting like the lowdown on like who this family is and everything, like, you know, even his departure from the house, like, you know, he goes and kisses his son goodbye, and you know, like Dudley's kind of throwing like a tantrum and he's like, oh, little tyke, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it's like, this is one of those things where it's like, you can't really fault them for just being like non-magical. Like, you know, for the most part, like when you look at the Dursleys, at least, you know, for these first couple of pages, it's sort of like, they are living their version of a happy life. You know, it's like,
right.
it's okay if it's not the version that you prefer, but it's like, on some level, I'm like, are we being overly harsh on them too quickly when it seems like they just kind of like, you know.
Well, I think even before Harry arrives, it's pretty clear that they're not like super great. Like, I mean, even like it, like, Petunia is introduced as like constantly listening in on the neighbors.
That's true.
Way in which Vernon is like judging the people dressed on the street and stuff like that, like just right away. It seems like they are very anti anything that is not regular.
Yes.
And not just like uncomfortable by it, but like actively going out of their way to like not like it or to be bothered by it, almost.
Right. Yeah, like anything out of the ordinary is seen in a negative light from them. So I'm not here to grandstand and stand in defense of the Dursleys or anything like that, but like, you know, I'm reading like that first chapter and him kissing, you know, Dudley goodbye before he takes off for his day at work, and I'm like, that is how I left my house this morning.
Right.
You know, like, I did do that exact same thing before I left, sans the little tight comment, but Otherwise, let's see here. Yeah, you do get to Grunnings, where of course Mr. Dursley sells drills, and I do think right away where you kind of get that feeling that maybe they're not the greatest is the line specifically says he yelled at 5 different people, he made several important telephone calls, and shouted a bit more. He was in a very good mood until lunchtime. No. And it's like
really just can't wait to get to work and start yelling at people.
I know. It's like this is like one of those things where in my mind I have no ability but to assume that anybody who shows up to work and has to use yelling as like a means to get the job done is either by absolute sheer necessity, like of the volume of the work environment, and yelling is just required to overtake what the otherwise noise of a loud space could be.
Right.
Or this is somebody who is having their own like internal personal struggles that like needs to resort to yelling to feel some measure of control over the circumstance that they're in. It is an odd or foreign belief to me to imagine a world where somebody actually experiences joy through yelling. So that's pretty much as soon as I get to the point with it's like, okay, maybe Mr. Dursley, maybe Vern isn't the best.
Yeah, I know. So even before that, I want to like the very first sentence that really stood out to me as I'm reading through it reads, "When Mr. and Mrs. Dursley woke up on the dull gray Tuesday our story starts, there was nothing about the cloudy sky outside to suggest the strange and mysterious things would soon be happening all over the country." Which I like the sentence so much because this is the one where it says where the dull gray Tuesday our story starts. Like us, we the audience, we're all going together.
Right.
Like you the reader are not referenced again as far as I know.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I don't know any other occasion where the narrator references you in any capacity. But so that is a unique use of the word our.
That is a unique use of the word our right here. But I also think it's funny because I just looked it up because the day in question is November 1st, 1981. That's the Potters are attacked on October 31st, 1981 when Harry is a 1-year-old. So it says it's a dull gray Tuesday morning, and November 1st, 1981 is actually a Sunday. So it's just like right away, like that's just not the right day of the week. And you totally could have looked that up. And I don't know why it's wrong. But the fact that it's wrong, you wouldn't think it's like, yeah, whatever. Just pick. And I feel like the reason Tuesday is chosen is because it's the most boring day of the week. It's like Monday is, of course, a terrible day because it's, you know, you have to go back to work. But Tuesday is not even halfway through the work. You know, at least Monday has the honor of being the start of the week. Tuesday is still the front half of the week and boring. Like, no, no, no. So I think that's why that day in particular was chosen, but it's just it's just not what day it was.
I know, yeah, which feels like one of those things that would have been easy enough to adjust up. But we'll of course see more of that in the future. I think we referenced this in episode 0 just a little bit, but sort of like obviously eventually as they're headed to Hogwarts on the Hogwarts Express each year in September, it is always September 1st, which I think is also always a Sunday.
Yeah, because they always get there for the feast, and then the next morning is always Monday and the first day of classes.
Right, and it's like kind of like one of those, like you know what, it's easier than trying to figure out how to have anything else. And there is something kind of like glorious and happy and exciting about like the like September 1st being more of like a fixture rather than like a rotating
They have to deal, like, you know, wizards don't have to deal with calendars, of course. Like, we just operate, we make our own days.
Exactly.
But like the fact that they get the day is wrong actually comes into play like 3 paragraphs later, where we're introduced to the first magical character of the entire series, Professor Minerva McGonagall in cat form, watching Privet Drive, and Mr. Dursley sees her as a cat reading a map, which, like, you don't think about it at the time, because when you're reading it the first time, you don't know that the cat is Professor McGonagall and that as a professor she works at Hogwarts and all of that nonsense. But if you scale it back, the fact of the matter is that it is described as being a Tuesday, November 1st. So this is well into the start of the school year, and it's just a Tuesday, and McGonagall is just skipping school, just skipping class. Like, she should be teaching on this day. What's she doing? And I know it's really what I love so much about this tiny mistake is that it's like, you might think, well, sure, but Voldemort just fell the night before, so clearly, like, everyone was given the day off. Like, that's why there's a holiday. And yet that cannot be true because McGonagall is there to confirm the fact that Voldemort fell with Dumbledore. So even if like someone at the school was the one giving her the day off under the belief that this had been true, that person would still have been Dumbledore because he's her boss.
Right.
So she wouldn't need to come to the house for confirmation from Dumbledore if she'd been given the day off because of the occasion. So I think that's really funny.
And it is like one of the age old questions that we have going on here as well is simply like that the attack happens on Halloween night. So October 31st, this is of course like the entire next day that McGonagall is now present and sitting on the wall and watching over the Dursleys and trying to get confirmation that what they believe to be true is in fact true. And then of course it is not until that evening, I believe at midnight, when Hagrid ultimately delivers Harry to the Dursleys' front doorstep.
Right, so it's like, where was he all day?
Yeah, so Hagrid's missing day is sort of like one of these grand mysteries that sort of like, isn't totally resolved. I mean, I suppose that there's something to be said for the fact that we know eventually in the story, diving way, way, way down the line, that Dumbledore does invoke some ancient magic in order to provide, the protection that Harry has at the Dursleys' home, thanks in part to Petunia's relationship to Lily, and therefore, like, Voldemort cannot touch Harry while he is there. So it is entirely possible that what is happening here is a grand amount of instruction on the part of Dumbledore, you know, who first went to Hagrid and assigned him this mission and told him to essentially tend to Harry for one whole day while he was able to go through and do all of Dumbledore type things, which is essentially like seeing between the lines. What Dumbledore knows is that like Voldemort is not gone for good, and he knows right away.
He knows right away because he's already aware of the prophecy and stuff like that. So he's like already setting up for Voldemort's return, like as of this night already.
Yes. He's
ready for it. But there continues to be little things like this that like don't add up, because when Dumbledore eventually does arrive later that day, he talks to McGonagall and he confirms with her that, it must have been Hagrid who told you I'd be here later on. And it's like, when did Hagrid tell McGonagall that he was coming to this address? Because McGonagall, when she sees Harry, it's clearly the first time she's seen him. And it's like, but Hagrid goes and gets Harry immediately and presumably has him the entire time. So when did Hagrid run into McGonagall and then McGonagall leaves to go meet up with Hagrid later?
These are the really complicated questions. I mean, on that note, as long as you want to split hairs, the weatherman who's speaking in this particular chapter,
Jim McGuffin.
Jim McGuffin, of course. Good trivia for you.
Yeah.
Also does claim that while he can't ensure something, he is sure that it will be a wet evening. I don't know about that, but it's not only the owls that have been acting oddly lately today. Let's see here. They've had a downpour of shooting stars. Perhaps people have been celebrating bonfire night early. It's not until next week, folks, but I can promise a wet night tonight. There we go. I got there eventually.
Also wrong.
Also wrong, because it's like there's no mention whatsoever of a light drizzle happening as McGonagall and Dumbledore and Hagrid are leaving baby Harry, who otherwise apparently is in the rain on the front doorstep all night.
I know. It's possible it starts raining later in the night, like 1 or 2 in the morning, which means they leave him out in the raid, which is also not great for them. But before they even get there, let's see, there's a few other things that happened during the day. Bonfire night, and this is like an American versus like European thing. Like, we don't have bonfire night.
We do not have bonfire night yet, so this is it's not something that registered, but it's a reference to Guy Fawkes,
and like if you ever see like V for Vendetta, it's like remember the 5th of November, which actually would be the next week because it is November 1st as he's saying that.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Of course. Yep.
So that is accurate.
Right. Guy Fawkes is in fact where, Fox the Phoenix gets his name from.
Yes.
Yeah, so is that same person.
Other little fun, tidbit there. I also love that, while Vernon is out at work during this day, this is one of the things that you maybe like skips by you when you're just listening on the audio, but like he overhears someone whispering about the Potters and they're like, yeah, their son Harry. And he's like, he's never even met his nephew. He wasn't even sure his nephew was named Harry. Could be Harvey or Harold or something. And I love that one of the names he tries to reassure himself with is Harold, as if Harry isn't just a nickname for people named Harold.
Yep, yep. It's like we jokingly in office refer to him as Harold Potter all the time.
Yeah,
as if we're just using like his long form name there.
Yep.
Yep. No, I think that's another great one. Although interestingly, there is the line about how the Dursleys had never met their nephew before, which is something that actually does hold up to the continuity pretty well, because at this point in time, the Potters would be in hiding.
Because that's true.
The prophecy does take place prior to the birth of both Harry and Neville, the two people that the prophecy could in fact refer to.
Although, now that you mention it, doesn't Lily in her letter to Sirius mention like a vase or something that came from Petunia?
Yes, that is in fact a thing.
Right, so, and they're in hiding at that point?
Well, somehow, some way, Petunia must have had special circumstances. Otherwise. Maybe Petunia is best friends with Peter Pettigrew, which somehow seems possible.
Because he's dating Pierce Polkus's mom, right?
Yeah, yeah, naturally. Yeah. We have an entire rap about that. Yeah, about how Peter Pettigrew possibly has a child, and it is one of Dudley's friends. Piers Polkus.
Yep.
We'll come back to that here, I think, in the next couple of chapters as well. Other really cool moments that we do have inside of this chapter are, of course, the line from Dumbledore where he says, "I would trust Hagrid with my life."
Oh, yep.
This is like one of those things where I think it establishes very early on in the story the fact that Dumbledore does not practice some of the same prejudices that you may expect within the wizarding world, even though at this point in time, we don't know that much about Hagrid at all.
No, we don't. Other than that, McGonagall is like, she seems to be less trustful of Hagrid in this moment.
Yes, yes. And this is kind of like one of those interesting things where the trust that Dumbledore does bestow on Hagrid is kind of interesting, and also you know, it could be argued unexplained. You know, as the Fantastic Beasts series was coming out, and beasts were so at the forefront and center of the conversation.
Yeah.
And we knew that at some point in time in that saga, we would cross over into when Hagrid would have had his time. You know, of course, at school, mm-hmm. we kept operating under the belief that at some point in time, Hagrid is going to have to show up and be relevant to, you know, to how Gellert Grindelwald is ultimately defeated.
Oh yeah, you'd
think so. And we don't ever get, you know, that ultimate explanation.
Yeah, because the final duel between Dumbledore and Grindelwald happens in 1945, and by that point, Tom Riddle has been expelled or has unleashed the basilisk in the Chamber of Secrets.
And Hagrid has been expelled.
So yeah. At some point, like, Hagrid has already been like at least a relevant student to Dumbledore at that point.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And because he's good with beasts, and he immediately hires him back, you'd think he had to have shown up in the Fantastic Beasts movies.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So our standing theory there is as to why Dumbledore has always had such trust in Hagrid is that Hagrid must have done something so, like that showed such support for the man himself that Dumbledore was like, If he supported me then, he will support me always, and I will have the undying faith in this person in that regard. However, again, that's all speculation because we never actually get a full-blown explanation for it.
We do not.
But I do love that it establishes very early sort of like what Dumbledore's position is going to be, you know, kind of all throughout. That does remain true. The other really amazing kind of piece that you and I both have observed and loved about this particular chapter is the prominence of three characters in particular, all of whom play absolutely vital roles to Harry during his sort of like you know, formative years, which is, of course, Rubeus Hagrid, Albus Dumbledore, and mention of Sirius Black.
There is, yeah, which is really interesting because I think those are it sounds like those are the first three people Harry has contact with after the attack.
It is, right? Yeah. Yep.
So Sirius shows up. He's got, yeah, so the Potters are attacked. Sirius shows up to the house, and he's holding Harry. That's when Hagrid shows up and says, "Give him to me." And then Hagrid has him presumably all day, apparently talks to McGonagall at some point and tells him he's going to Privet Drive that night.
Apparently.
But apparently, who knows? But then later, Hagrid hands him directly to Dumbledore. So it goes from Sirius to Hagrid to Dumbledore, which is, it is so, this is like one of the craziest details ever. But a couple years ago, Ben and I got invited out to London to visit the British Library, where they had this history of magic exhibit on display, and it had just like all of like the history behind all of the things you hear about in the wizarding world. And by far the coolest thing they had there was this thing called the Ripley Scroll, which was this like 23-foot long scroll,
It's like a massive piece of like parchment that is like beautifully like illustrated and is essentially or supposedly the actual formula in order to create the Philosopher's Stone, like the real thing. So not to get too far ahead in our story here, but Nicholas Flamel is a actual real life human being who lived, I think, in the 14 or 1500s and had supposedly, and of course unconfirmed, created or sought to create the Philosopher's Stone.
The Philosopher's Stone, which can turn metals into gold and gives you the elixir of life.
Yes. And one of the most remarkable elements, you know, just to bring us back to Hagrid, Sirius, and Dumbledore here, is that like the final like three ingredients visible on the actual Ripley scroll. Again, this is not like manufactured for the wizarding world. This is a real historical artifact.
Right. Of people trying to actually practice alchemy and literally create the Philosopher's Stone.
Right. And so the last three ingredients are visualized as a red orb, a black orb, and a white orb that come together to create what you ultimately have is the Philosopher's Stone.
Right.
And what is unbelievable about this, and the moment that we saw it, I mean, like you and I both, our jaws just kind of like hit the floor because we're like, wait, Rubaeus means red.
Yeah. And Albus means white.
And Sirius black gives you those three stones. Those three men are arguably the closest to surrogate father figures for Harry, and they're the ones who, you know, through his life kind of forge him into the man that he becomes, which sort of brings you to this argument that like Harry, who ultimately will eventually become Master of Death, is sort of equating to the Elixir of Life. And Harry, who is so frequently throughout the story embodied by the color gold.
Right.
It's like these three people come together, the red, black, and white, to create the Philosopher's Stone, which is
Harry. Right. So it's like, it's called the Philosopher's Stone, and there's a physical object in the book called the Philosopher's Stone, but Harry is the Philosopher's Stone.
Yes.
Like, it's so easy to just, like, the Philosopher's Stone ends up sort of just being, like, a MacGuffin by the end of the story. It's like, it doesn't come into play anymore, but it's like, that's because it's not really about the stone. It's because Harry himself is about the stone. Not only is he constantly represented by the color gold, like, when they make the Polyjuice Potion for Harry later on, it turns gold. His wand shoots golden fire. He chases the golden snitch. But the other half of it is that it gives you the elixir of life so that you can't die. And Harry literally comes back from the dead.
Yeah.
So
and is in fact Master
of Death. Yeah. It's like really, it's set up right from the beginning, especially if you know about the Ripley Scroll, that like he's attacked and then boom, right away, red, black, white are the first three people who physically touch him.
Yes.
And it's like, that's crazy that it's set up so perfectly like that. And it's like, and it's just cool because like, this is like the, you know, Hagrid just mentions like, oh, got it off young Sirius Black. And it's like, oh yeah, that's just some off page character. Probably don't need to worry about him.
Right,
a minute. Like that I think is the number one detail when you reread the books again, after you've read it the first time, you're like,
it's like, no way. Cause I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, now at this point in time, I suspect that if you're listening to this podcast, you too have combed through these books over and over and over again. And maybe have law, like, you know, every time you see it exactly what it means, but like when we were kids reading through this for the very first time, like Sirius Black didn't remain in the back of my mind for years.
Oh, and years.
So like, no. When you hear his name again in Prisoner of Azkaban, it's not like you're not like being like, oh yeah, like the the one with the motorbike. Like not at all. You know, you've long forgotten at that point. It's been 3 years since you've read those words.
That was the bitch. I mean, it'd be the same as trying to remember Daedalus Diggle, who also gets a name drop here in the first chapter.
Yes, he sure does. Yeah, we eventually go on to learn is, in fact, you know, of course, a member of the Order of the Phoenix and will eventually be the one to escort the Dursleys to safety.
Yeah, so that's it's funny that he gets mentioned so early. What's funny about that is that McGonagall thinks it's Daedalus Diggle who's doing the shooting stars down in Kent. He never had much sense or whatever.
Oh, yeah, right.
What I think
is
so funny about that is she's telling Dumbledore about this, and like McGonagall, surprisingly, was not a member of the First Order of the Phoenix.
It is surprising.
In the First Wizarding War, but she wasn't. Daedalus Diggle was. Right. So she's like sitting here like telling Dumbledore, like, oh, probably Daedalus Diggle. Meanwhile, Dumbledore's like, I'm the leader of a secret society fighting Voldemort, and that's one of my members. So, so let me tell you, Minerva, why weren't you in class today?
Someone playing hooky?
Someone playing hooky, were they? Playing cat, were they?
Popcorn culture is supported by Arena Club.
Okay, so you guys know that I love trading card games and that me and Ben are big time collectors of Pokemon cards. You know, it's that childhood fantasy of finally being able to use adult money to buy those highly coveted rares of our youth. And like, even in our office, we have not one, but two full display cases with some of our all time favorite rarest cards that we've pulled. But something I did not know existed when I was a kid in my youth was the grading process for trading cards or sports cards or whatever you're collecting. You know, to me, it was just like a rare Charizard is a rare Charizard. Like, it doesn't matter if it's been hanging out in my pocket with my lucky paper clip. Turns out it does matter, and kind of a lot, because if you get your cards professionally graded, it can add huge value. And then not only that, but once they're graded, they will like seal them in that pristine condition inside of a plastic case, or what's known in the industry as a slab. And that's where Arena Club steps in, because it's like buying a booster pack, but it's for a pre-graded card. Now, I know that can take like maybe a second to wrap your head around, because you're opening physical cards on a digital platform, which means you open the pack online and see your pulls where they can be added to your showroom for the world to see, but you can also request them to be sent to you at any time. So they have got a ton of pre-graded cards, and then you will get to randomly open one, and then they'll keep it for you, or they can send it to you, or you can just like sell it or trade it online or whatever you want to do. But whether you're buying, selling, trading, or displaying, Arena Club is the card collecting platform you have got to check out. And right now, you can get 10% off your first purchase by going to arenaclub.com/poppop, which, wow, that is a crazy offer. 10% off a $400 slab pack. That's like $40 right there. Anyway, that's arenaclub.com/poppop for 10% off your first purchase.
Popcorn Culture is sponsored by Shopify. Y'all are likely aware of the fact that we have our very own Shopify store, Carlin Brothers Mercantile, and it's hard to imagine not having it now, but arriving at the decision to open our own web store was a big one. In fact, we started our journey on the interweb back in 2012 and didn't finally open up shop until 2018. And a huge part of that is just not knowing where to start, but that's where Shopify steps in. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, which is a fancy way of saying it's a really easy and effective way to start an online business, no matter if you're operating out of your garage or have like a whole building or three or something. Once we were set up, our biggest concern was trying a new product, only to discover no one was interested in it. But Shopify is powered with so many reports, more than you can even imagine. And this is so handy because it allows us to use data to better provide what folks are actually interested in. It's so easy to use, but even if you do find yourself caught in a jam, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/poppop. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/poppop now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/poppop.
There's also, man, McGonagall, I feel like, definitely goes through a big transformation. The more you get to know her. I do love that one of the very first things she does is, as a cat, gives Uncle Vernon a stern look. And it's like, classic McGonagall.
Classic.
Classic McGonagall. But then, like, it is surprising to me as you go on that she's a little bit superior about being a wizard versus the muggles. Like, at one point she's like, well, they're not completely stupid. It's like, well, yeah, we know that. Certainly muggles aren't completely stupid.
Yes, right? No, this is like, yeah, it's one of those things where it is very interesting just to see, like, the various differences between the you know, like the magical philosophy versus the non-magical philosophy, and of course we will eventually come to learn again in the story that it's not like muggles are the ones exclusively known for maybe spoiling their children. I mean, Dudley and eventually, you know, who will meet as the character of Draco Malfoy are not terribly dissimilar, you know, in their upbringing and their air of superiority over others.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, I mean, that's like, it's like McGonagall maybe needs to, you know, she can maybe check it a little bit.
She can maybe check it a little bit. There's also like a funny line here, I thought, where when Dumbledore shows up and he's like, I should have known. And that's him looking up and seeing McGonagall sitting as a cat at Privet Drive all day.
Right.
And he's like, and she transforms and she says, how did you know it was me, Albus? And it's like, this is one of those things where it's like suffering from like pilot episode-itis or whatever.
It is, because
in hindsight, like, there's, first of all, no way that Dumbledore doesn't know McGonagall is an animagus that can turn into a cat and doesn't know exactly what she looks like. And there's no way McGonagall doesn't know that Dumbledore knows what she looks like, because this is her trick during the first class of literally every year. Like, even when Harry and Ron are unimpressed by it or whatever, like, she says, that's the first time my class has not been impressed by this, suggesting she does it every year.
And we learned
that she's a registered animagus. So it's like, of course he knows she's a cat and knows exactly what she looks like. So, like, that line does not age well.
No. I mean, it doesn't. But I think that the great, like, forgiveness is exactly what you're saying. It's sort of like that pilot episode sort of, like situation where it's like, you need to do some exposition along the way. You need to sort of, like, introduce the readers a little bit to what kinds of magic is possible, what types of objects you might see, like, what these characters are like, how they behave. Because, I mean, similarly, you know, we also have, you know, Dumbledore, of course, pulling out the very famous, you know, putter-outer or put-outer.
The put-outer. Yeah, I think it's funny that it's called the put-outer here and later gets renamed to the way better Deluminator.
Same exact thing, you know, we'll see in Prisoner of Azkaban is eventually the reference to the, you know, the guards of Azkaban.
Oh, yeah, versus Dementors.
Dementors, yeah. You know, it's like as soon as they've been referred to as Dementors once, as soon as our characters have learned that name once, it's like, well, from now on, they're just Dementors.
Yeah, now they're just the Dementors.
But it's like, why doesn't everybody refer to them as Dementors up until this? Why have they always been the Azkaban guards?
And I
think, like, those are bits of forgiveness that I don't struggle with at all, because it's sort of just like, okay, like, we're kind of getting the wheels in motion here. For the most part, you know, it's not like we never see McGonagall as an animagus again. It's just sort of like, Dumbledore absolutely knows.
Yeah, it is. I think it's just funny, the little things that, like, stand out like that. Like, even the fact that, like, as Vernon's going to work that day, there's people, like, already celebrating in the streets, like, Voldemort's down, hooray, amazing. And it's like there's all these rumors immediately flying about the Potters and how Harry toppled him or whatever. And it's like, how could there be rumors already? You know, that part baffles me as well, because, like, the Fidelius charm breaks and then Sirius is there and then Hagrid's there. And then that's, like, you know, what would have happened that would have alerted everyone else and tuned them into the fact that it was Harry that stopped Voldemort, like, right away?
Well, we've got the Sirius Black's attack on Peter Pettigrew.
There is that.
In a fairly public way.
That happens in a fairly public way, but this is happening, like, the stuff's happening, like, as Vernon's driving to work, and, like, I think that happens in broad daylight is what it said.
This is a good point. Well, yeah. The other thing I think we can certainly have happening is, like, you know, Godric's Hollow, we'll eventually learn, is a neighborhood so named for Godric Gryffindor, of course, but is both a muggle and wizard occupied town.
Mm-hmm.
And of course is where the Potters lived. The Fidelius charm is, of course, protecting their location. We know that the backfiring of Avada Kedavra spell is what will break down the Fidelius charm and reveal the Potters' location to, you know, the outside world, which is then how, you know, Sirius is able to go and enter the fray and find baby Harry still alive inside of the house, how Hagrid could also go and collect him. Because, gosh, is there anything sadder than a world where Harry backfires spells and then nobody can find him?
Oh, I know, right, yeah.
Due to the Fidelius charm. Like, that's horrifying to think about. And so the only other thing I can imagine is like possibly once the Fidelius charm is broken, then people who had known that the Potters had lived there, who had forgotten per the Fidelius charm, are now aware of their presence and the otherwise loud explosion and took to the streets, you know, because, you know, similarly, I mean, somehow Sirius Black must have been informed. Somebody must have known to contact him as well, right?
I think Sirius, like, went to, he hadn't heard from Peter in a while, and he went to go check on him, and he saw that Peter had, like, abandoned his home or whatever, and as soon as he saw that, he was like, uh-oh.
Okay,
and then he went to go check on the Potters, and that's when he found Harry.
And that's when he found Harry, okay. Yeah, so there you go.
There's that. I suppose the other thing that's possible is that Voldemort has a bunch of people under the Imperius curse, and after he, like, falls, like, they would all be released.
True.
And they could maybe come to their senses about it. So that could, I guess, give away that Voldemort was gone. And then maybe people could start piecing it together. Like, oh my God, the Potters. Oh, we know where the Potters are. And people started being released from the curse.
Right, right. And that's a curious one as well, where it'd be interesting if you've been under the Imperius curse for such a long period of time, it's possible the last actual memory you have would be being placed under it.
Yeah, sure.
And therefore, you know, you might be like, oh my gosh, like, what is going on? Where have I been? What have I been doing this whole time? So yeah, there are certainly some things that would happen that we'll learn about later in the story that could have unfolded or been undone. And again, otherwise, you know, I think it's just sort of one of those, like, if you want to look at Petunia as the example. So she's somebody who stands there and as a muggle is effectively, like, you know, doing the whole, like, grapevine sort of gossip over the hedge, you know, type of thing. And this is sort of like the wizards almost doing the exact same thing, which is just rumor flying mad,
all
you
over
know,
the place,
and quickly, in such a big way. So, all very interesting. Another piece of it is the fact that, you know, McGonagall refers to the fact that it's been, 11 years, or I think Dumbledore says it's been 11 years since they've had anything to celebrate.
Yeah.
You know, so of course, like, everybody wants to. This is another one of those kind of, like, interesting things as we learn more about the overall narrative of the story and the rough timeline. Like, I believe that Tom Riddle graduates from Hogwarts in the early 1940s. And we know that at that point in time, he will eventually be, you know, hunting Horcruxes and doing his whole thing to kind of become immortal and everything.
But 11 years prior would be like 1970. Right.
Yeah. 11 years prior would be 1970. So there has always been this kind of large and unusual swath of time from, I think, the late 1950s when we last see Tom Riddle doing anything, up until, like, it's like there's like a 15-year gap where it's like he must have been, like, much more underground, like planning a lot of stuff.
Because there's a huge gap of time. Because, like, he unleashes the basilisk before he even graduates school. So that's when he makes the diary Horcrux. And then we know that immediately upon graduating, he pretty quickly acquires the diadem and the cup as Horcruxes. And then the locket.
Yeah, it's the locket in the cup, which he gets from
Hepzibah Smith.
Of course, yeah. Hepzibah
and then
Smith.
I guess maybe he talked to the Grey Lady while he was at school and found the diadem that way. And then what else was he still missing then? The ring he took from Morphin.
Yep. The ring he has graduating school.
Before graduating
school. Because
he's
wearing it in Slughorn's.
So, like, possibly he's just spending the rest of the time looking for, like, the sword or anything of Gryffindor's, you'd think?
Right, yeah. In our long theory for a very long period of time, this is one of my all-time favorites, is that he, we eventually will learn as well that Molly Weasley, her surname originally was, before marriage, was Pruitt.
Yes.
And she had two brothers, Fabian and Gideon, where you'll eventually get the F and G that become Fred and George. And eventually, I believe Harry receives for his 17th birthday from Mrs. Weasley the signature gift of the golden watch from that was Fabian's. And we know that, like, we've got these members of the original Order of the Phoenix. We know that Lily and James themselves, as well as Neville's parents, have thrice defied the Dark Lord. So we know that they were attacking Gryffindor based wizards throughout this whole era of time, and it may be the case that Voldemort had learned the legend that the Sword of Gryffindor will present itself to a Gryffindor in need,
right?
And therefore, like, that was, like, he's pummeling these wizards in the name of attempting to get the sword to appear to one of them, which we can only assume he had successfully done. And basically was using this last final piece to essentially immortalize himself, you know, by way of his seven Horcruxes and entering the Potter's home, and was intending to create his final Horcrux with the death of the boy who was mentioned in the prophecy.
Right, because, like, that's the other thing, is Dumbledore eventually tells Harry he's positive that Voldemort was going to use Harry's death to make the final Horcrux.
Yes.
And so to that end, he must have had the item with him when he went, and the clear thing he's missing is a relic of Gryffindor's, which, like, and you're right, the Pruitts were killed by Death Eaters, like, in a big struggle, and they would have been true Gryffindors who potentially the sword could have presented itself to. They could have recovered the sword, given it to Voldemort. There's also, like, this weird time gap where you know that Wormtail is the secret keeper and a mole. So, like, there's no reason he almost shouldn't immediately tell Voldemort, but then they're clearly in hiding for more than, like, a day. So it's like they're in there hiding for, like, months.
Right.
You know, so it's like, why does he take so long to finally go and attack the Potters? And it's like, because he doesn't have the sword yet.
Yes.
Or something of Gryffindor. So yeah, it feels like there is a lot lining up for, like, Voldemort finally got the sword and was going to turn it into a Horcrux, and then obviously the entire plan failed. And then, of course, the reason the sword's not there is because one of the sword's tricks is that it disappears.
Yes.
So there it is. And then it's like, we also know the sword does not have to appear via the sorting hat. Like, that's how Neville and Harry get to it. But, like, Snape just puts it in the pond, and that's a totally acceptable way for it to have been presented to, I guess, Ron in that situation.
Yeah. This is one of those big questions where it's like the sentience of the sword itself is questionable, because it seems as though from the moment that Harry takes it from the hat, you know, in year two, it just resides in the headmaster's office up until the time that Snape basically, like, leaves it for them. In that instance, there is the really fun fact that and this is, like, I have no idea whether or not it was intentional, but it's glorious either way. But the fact that the sword presents itself through the sorting hat is like
sorting hat,
the sorting hat, the sorting hat, the sorting hat.
Yeah.
Like, it's like oh my gosh. And of course, the sorting hat being the other viable option of an artifact of Godric Gryffindor's, that could have been used. However, I suspect the reason that the sorting hat wouldn't have been a great candidate for this final Horcrux is due to the fact that it's like a being missing would be might invite seekers, to speak.
For,
you know,
sure.
It's like a lot of these other artifacts.
Yeah, if you uncover the Sword of Gryffindor, like, no one's even gonna know.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Because nobody otherwise really, you know, similar to the Diadem of Ravenclaw, it's like nobody really knows where it is. So,
right.
But anyway, I mean, as far as those things are concerned, I mean, the Lost Diadem of Ravenclaw has been gone for literal, like centuries, almost a millennium. Whereas, you know, the sword is like, so if anything, it seems like the Diadem is still harder to get.
I know.
So I love the idea that Voldemort was walking into the Potters that night. Although with the only thing that I could imagine being so unbelievably cool, although it changed the entire story, is an unarmed Lily, being in the room, basically like defending her son no matter what, having an instance where the sword just, like, appears in her hand or something.
Oh,
and
wow.
Then she's like Lily standing there with the Sword of Gryffindor against Voldemort would be, I mean, the epic scene
crazy.
In my head, it's like we could do an entire what if, where what if the Sword of Gryffindor presented itself to
Lily
in that
she
moment.
She just slashes him down
and
right
she just
there.
Wins. Yeah, that's just right it. There. No, this, no other story.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. End of game right there, Voldemort. I guess it wouldn't have the basilisk venom yet. So this is another one. It's like the Sword of Gryffindor must have, like, other magical properties inside of it that like Harry and Hermione and Dumbledore never like activate or even aware of, you know? Like,
oh, true,
is the basilisk venom the first time it ever absorbed something that made it stronger? Like, that doesn't seem right.
No, it doesn't seem likely at all. Yeah. And so I suspect that if we ever learn more history of that sort, we'll learn a lot more of what that thing had at its disposal.
Oh, I know. I so badly want there to be a Founder series where you just get to see Gryffindor out there, like, wielding the sword and doing his thing. And,
it would be so cool. You know, it would be so cool.
Hamming
so.
It up with old Sal.
Right. Yeah. The best of buds.
The best of buds. You just imagine Helga and Rowena where they're just rolling in their eyes like they left again, didn't they? They're going, okay.
Should Did we he bring help? The sword?
He bring the sword. I'll get the cup.
Like, what does the cup do?
What does the cup do? I know.
It turns water to wine. I think we know that much.
That would be the fun part about the Founders is that they, like, until like the very like last, the end of the show, the four of them are just best buds. You know, like they're actual friends.
Yes.
And it's like, and I mean, obviously there's a big crack at the end and that's tragic or whatever. But for the majority of the show, they're all just chums.
Right. Like you love their friendship.
Like you love that. That has to be it. That has to be it.
It does. It does. Someday we'll get it.
Someday it will be a Founder series. And that I can't wait. That's the number one thing that I want from Harry Potter.
There you go. Well, Jay, I think to kind of close out today's episode, I think, you know, there's a couple of other like little tidbits that I would love to touch on.
Okay, absolutely.
I think one of the big things that I reflected on a lot as I was reading, you know, this first chapter, especially like, you know, hard copy, as we're saying, like, you know, kind of going through and like feeling the pages, seeing the words on, you know, like in text and everything. I mean, it does bring me back. And I was reminiscing a lot on kind of exactly what we said, you know, reading it, our dad reading it to us when we were kids. You know, I think the other big one is there's this one line in particular that I think, like hit me so hard because since, you know, reading these pages for the first time as a young kid, we both now have our own kids, you know, mm-hmm. kids of our own. I've got my daughter Addison, and you've got your three boys.
Yes, I do. Got my own troublesome twins, Nick and Nate, and then my eldest son Luke.
Yep. Yeah. But the line that got me was the one small hand closed on the letter beside him.
Oh.
And this is just like one of those things where it's like, you know, I mean, you know, my like Addie's coming up on being two as of recording this, and you know, it's like it is one of those things like, you know, where a lot of times I'll put her to bed and I'll pull her up on the monitor, I'll see her like, you know, holding on to like her like little like kind of rectangle of fabric that she calls her Ono. But you know, it's like that thought of like seeing this like small child clutching on to, you know, this letter that's mm-hmm. going to be so impactful for the rest of its life, rest of his life, you know, it's just very emotional. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, like the poor kid. You know, he's just lost
he's
everything.
Just a little boy. He has no idea.
Yeah, and he's about to be left with just
the worst people, and they're gonna lie to him about what happened for the next 10 years.
Yes, yeah, just really. I mean, it's like I think my heart goes out to baby Harry so hard. So that was just what I wrote in the margin next to that one was just tears. You know, because I think I was just very very emotional moment.
I know it changes when you get older.
It does. Yeah, a big perspective shift when you're now looking at it through the lens of parenthood. And then of course the last one. You know, one of my favorite things I think is, you know, the clever naming of the chapter is simply The Boy Who Lived. But ultimately there's a small modification that you can make to that phrase. That sort of sums up the whole series from the very beginning, which is changing the word from lived to loved, and it's Harry Potter, the boy who loved. And eventually what we'll see unfold with this character, with, you know, with the story, is that this is really the defining characteristic that Harry is capable of. That
is a secret weapon.
Yes. And you know, I mean, it's you know, you see it be so difficult for Dumbledore to ingrain this message into Harry. And you know, I think at some point in time, like Harry says, like, yeah, I can love, you know,
yeah, big deal.
I had to hold myself from saying, yeah, big deal. But it is just, it is really like a remarkable thing. And I've always loved that, you know, that it's like that the you're literally one letter off from.
Yeah. The
like,
boy who loved.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And I almost feel like it would have made for a fantastic final chapter name, like if the story had started with the boy who lived.
Yeah. I mean, you almost could have called the last chapter or the chapter where, like, I think it's called The Forest or something.
The Forest Again.
The Forest Again. That one could have been called The Boy Who Lived. Like, also.
Yes, that's true. You could have
just done it again.
It would have been
amazing. What it could have been. I guess you could have called King's Cross The Boy Who Lived or something. I don't know. You even could have just done the very last chapter. It could have bookended the whole thing.
That's true.
That would have been kind of funny. King's Cross is a pretty appropriate title name, I think, for that chapter. But we're way off that one.
I know. Yeah, we got a ways to go. We got a ways to go. So, but anyway, do you have any other closing thoughts? How did you feel kind of combing through this first chapter of our saga?
Oh, I mean, I loved it. This chapter is so fun. I mean, it sets up so many things so well. You get introduced to like so many big characters. I like there's other tiny little things I think are funny that like at the end Dumbledore he apparates off the spot and then like McGonagall turns back into a cat and slinks off and it's like why didn't you just apparate too? That doesn't make sense.
It's like, why did you? So you go back to school?
Yeah, I know. I think he even says that. He says, "I'll see you soon."
Right.
You mean tomorrow at class, right? Right.
Like literally immediately.
We're going to the same place, all three of us, because we all work there together.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think that's pretty funny. Then Hagrid flies off on the motorbike, and it's like, what happened to the motorbike? You know, it's just gone for, you know, seven books, and then it shows up again.
It shows back up, yeah. It's the thing that delivers him there. It's the thing that will eventually take him away from there.
Yeah, I think that's funny.
That is no mistake in my mind. I think eventually when it comes to the inevitable removal of Harry, you know, from the Dursleys, the fact that he entered and exited in
the
same
motorbike.
With the same person. Like that's on purpose.
That's absolutely on purpose. That's another great book. And I think there is a fun chapter. This like fast forwards the Chamber of Secrets a little bit. There's a chapter, there's a paragraph here where Dumbledore is explaining why it's important that Harry grow up away from being famous. He says, it would be enough to turn any boy's head. Famous before he can walk and talk. Famous for something he won't even remember. Can't you see how much better off he'll be growing up far away from all that until he's ready to take it? And it's like, that paragraph right there explains exactly, if you don't realize it, is why Dumbledore hires Lockhart in Chamber of Secrets, because this is what Harry could have been
if he
had like grown up maybe somewhere besides the Dursleys. Doesn't mean the Dursleys was a great choice. He says it's the best place for him, and it's like, you really, if you want to like unpack that sentence, when he's saying the best place, he doesn't mean it's the nicest place for him. He means it's the literal safest place, because Voldemort actually cannot get to him there.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I think that this is again probably where Dumbledore, because we know eventually when Dumbledore does go and speak to the Dursleys again face to face, he does sort of mention that, like, you know, when I left him on your doorstep all those years ago, I really hope that you would like love him and treat him as your own son, and I see that you've clearly not done that.
Right.
You know, and I think he makes a little remark about Dudley there. He's like, I can only be grateful that you haven't, you know, caused as much damage to Harry as you have to the boy sitting between you two.
They both look like someone here besides Dudley. I'm not seeing him.
What do you mean? Dudley's been treated great.
It's like, has he?
Yeah.
And you're, but
it's a good point, though, and I think that there's a lot to take away from that, because I actually highlighted that exact same that same sentiment, and I didn't actually write down the Lockhart, but I wrote down they did after all know James, and I think that there's a piece of that, like, you know, James is not for nothing, but a pretty cocky, arrogant kid. I mean, he has his own kind of like bullying tendencies. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's certain characteristics about him that, like, you know, it seems as though, like they always say, like, you know, Harry looks just like his father, except he got his mother's eyes, and it seems like also his mother's, you know, demeanor,
yeah,
along the way. You know, which is something I kind of see like interesting, be like a prevailing characteristic, you know, sort of through Harry. Despite maybe the Quidditch prowess, we will eventually see him also exhibit.
Yeah, also has that.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. But we did do one of my more favorite things that we've ever written for our Super Carlin Brothers YouTube channel was I think it was what if Sirius had raised Harry.
Oh yes,
you know, and instead, and
or it was really what if Neville was the chosen one?
That is exactly it. So what if Neville was the chosen one? In which case, what you would end up with is a scenario where Sirius is the one who raises Harry, and it was one of my favorite versions of Harry that we've ever concocted, because he sort of has some of the like jocular nature of James, but he's also got like that prevailing kindness, but then also Harry has like been raised by a very competent wizard for his whole life, so it's
he's
like
kind of got like a little bit like way more skill and knowledge of the wizarding world. He's sort of the Ron to Neville, like in that version. Neville has been basically successfully hidden by the Fidelius charm until he's going to Hogwarts.
Yes.
So he has been shielded from the wizarding world almost entirely, in the same way Harry usually is, but his best friend ends up being Harry, so Harry's sort of the Ron to Neville's Harry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Except, you know, like, but Harry's also got like the skill.
Yeah, but Harry's way more capable because it turns out when he's raised by Sirius, he's just teaching him all sorts of stuff and breaking the rules all the time. So
it was a blast.
That one's a really good version. So if you want to check that out, what if Neville was the chosen one?
There you go.
I mentioned that we would address the chapter art. So I love the chapter art in the books. I feel like that like formed the first pictures of like what I thought the characters looked like when we were growing up. So what do you think? The Boy Who Lived chapter art, chapter one, it's just Harry sitting in a bundle of blankets underneath the stars.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah,
I really love it. You can see his little tiny scar there.
There is, you can see the little scar.
Again, you know, because it goes back to that comment that I made, but I mean, it just makes me so mad. It makes me so sad for such a little, like innocent child who just basically like had so much, you know, like kindness and promise and love all around him, and to, you know, sort of be stripped of that. And I think like in this way, like when I look at this image, you know, it does make me so much more aware. Like, of course, like as Harry will get older, he'll be surrounded by his like, you know, dear friends. And I mean, Ron and Hermione and the rest of the Weasleys and Ginny and the rest, I mean, they are his family, but like, it does make you realize when you think about it, just from this, like this little boy who had to grow up, you know, for 10 years, essentially completely isolated and mistreated by the people that he's with. And then the whole saga that he has to go on, you know, I mean, it does make you just feel like how alone he was in some ways.
Yeah.
So I know that's probably like expanding beyond the image of a little boy wrapped up in blankets here a little bit, but, I am glad to see that the stars are visible above him and it has not yet started raining.
Well, other than that, I think the only other thing I had, written down here is like you mentioned, was the one line that I felt like really stood out to me. And it's like, you always talk about Harry Potter, the boy who lived, and it's not like a really, you know, it's a common phrase, but I feel like when you end the first chapter, just the final line with people toasting to Harry Potter, the boy who lived, like I was like, I get chills.
Oh, I know. I mean, and it's like the symbol that Harry, you know, kind of becomes to the wizarding world is, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's the expectations that he'll, as an individual, eventually face, which is like nobody can live up to the symbol that has been created around him for this defeat of someone who has caused so much darkness in this world. And, you know, against all odds, somehow, some way, Harry does.
Yeah.
You know,
it's literally like, lives up.
Yeah. Lives up, dies a little bit and lives some more.
Lives again.
So, I mean, it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It makes me so excited for, you know, the rest of the saga to come. I was really excited about just like, you know, one of the things that does blow my mind about this story is how much happens inside of one single chapter. Like I often think like you almost could have had like a prologue that tells you about the Dursleys a little bit, and then have chapter one, the boy who lived, and pretty much start with McGonagall and Dumbledore's exchange on Privet Drive.
Yeah,
there,
like just start with like Hagrid arriving or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially because it feels like that's sort of like when the part of the story you care the most about truly begins. It's like the magic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like, if anything, it's like, can we get past the Dursleys just as soon as seemingly possible?
I know.
I mean, I would like less time with them.
I know. What's interesting to me is that there's not zero magic in here. There's no wand magic just yet. I think the very first magic you ever see in the whole series is the Deluminator doing its thing.
Other than, of course, McGonagall being transformed.
Yeah, you see McGonagall as a transformed cat, but I guess when you're introduced to it, you maybe don't know that yet. So okay, yeah. I guess, yeah, either you could count it as McGonagall or the Deluminator, and then, of course, she transforms, and then there's that. And there's the flying motorbike as well.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Lots of stuff there.
Lots of stuff there. Yep. Other little fun fact, I just discovered this today, actually. I did not know this, but Privet Drive, I always assumed was supposed to be a little bit of a play on the word private.
Oh.
And I had not, maybe you knew this, I didn't. Privet is a kind of hedge.
Oh.
And I think that they are typically hedges that are, in fact, used like in suburban neighborhoods to kind of be barriers between your home and your neighbors.
Oh.
So
that's funny. I did not realize. I also thought it was private drive.
Yeah.
Because
I
like to be private.
Oh, actually, on that note, so these are two things I misheard as a child. So I actually thought that it was private drive. I didn't, like, the word privet as a, probably 9-year-old didn't register to me as meaning anything at all. The other was, of course, Dad was reading it to us, and I always heard Albus Dumbledore's name as Elvis.
Elvis.
So in my mind, I literally always assumed that I for some reason, I very quickly embodied Dumbledore with a sort of like very musical.
Very musical, like rock, king of rock and roll.
Yeah, kind of vibe. So I think I even remember getting like I think I was talking to you, actually, and it's probably would have been one of those first moments where our age difference or your just better memory than mine came up. But I remember saying like, didn't Elvis say something? And you're like, Elvis? And it was like, the headmaster. And you were like, it's Albus. And I was like, it is not. Where's the book?
Yeah.
And it was like, we went and picked it up and I was like, it's like literally just like one of those moments where I was like, Someone changed it,
man.
Certainly.
Mandela effect or whatever.
Yeah.
This is another little tiny thing like that. This is just a funny change from like the UK version of the book to the American one. It is the first word Dudley, or the new word that Dudley learned that day. In the American version, it's won't. But if you go to the UK version, it's shan't.
Oh, that's awesome.
Shan't do it.
I shan't.
Shan't.
Amazing.
I love the idea of a little baby just being like, shan't. Shan't.
It's especially funny because I always think that, in all the various languages across the world and stuff like that, very, very frequently, not always, you know, it seems like the word for like, you know, we say mom and dad, but like, or some variation of something similar to like mama, papa, like those types of words. And I sometimes like wonder whether or not like it's small children's early development of speech that actually is the like etymology behind those words.
Oh, probably.
Which you know, in the event, you know, I've heard my own daughter say won't before or no.
Yeah.
But you know, it makes me wonder if the word shan't is actually created in part by toddler speak, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's
could
it's,
be, yeah, right.
You know, a word created by youngins that the rest of us continue to use the rest of our lives. So that's funny. I did not realize that was different in the different narratives. And speaking of Dudley, looking forward to chapter 2, which will be our next episode, The Vanishing Glass. The chapter art is as soon as you turn over.
Wonderful.
Is a very prominent photo of little Dudders there surrounded by his many, many peasants.
36, counted them myself.
Oh, man. So, as ever, guys, thank you so much for tuning in to the very first episode of Through the Gryffindor. As this is our opening weekend, we will have our first 3 chapters all delivered to you here on October 1st, 2023. Henceforth, after this week, though, we will be going chapter by chapter with one new episode every Sunday each week. So be sure to, subscribe and tune in and do all the various things. The show should be available